So thank you for your practice this evening. I'm not sure if you have practiced Sila as a guided meditation before. I want to just pay respects to my teacher, Stephen Smith, my first Dharma teacher, who taught me Sila as a guided practice, which I have cherished over the last several decades as my retreat practice of, in case of emergency, break glass. When all else has failed, I always find that there a return to just the body, breath, nervous system. I just want to be okay. I just want to feel into that desire. I find it to be very restorative, especially when my mind is thinking else, thinking of other things that are not in that arena. So I want to talk about Sila and its schema in the practice, which many of you probably know, that really all Buddhist traditions, and certainly the Insight tradition, talk about the three trainings of the Eightfold Path. But I'm going to try to stay away from lists tonight. But we know we have the Eightfold Path, which is broke down into Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. And many of us are familiar with the Samadhi, which is really the mindfulness, the insight practice, the contemplative aspect of Dharma. Very big component. And out of that, we have Panya, or wisdom, or an understanding of things as they are. And then we have Sila, which is really the foundation of all of it. However, I have found over the years, this sort of gets a little bit left by the wayside, because I think as a culture, generally speaking, we're very interested in wisdom. We really want to understand things, don't we? We want to know. And then we think, and of course, mindfulness is in its, you know, explosion into the landscape. So there's a lot of emphasis on mindfulness and meditation and wisdom. But my understanding is that without a foundation rooted in Sila, the practice is fairly vacant. And it doesn't have the benefits that we think it's going to have by just sort of paying attention, being good at paying attention and understanding things. Part of wisdom, and a big aspect of wisdom, is understanding Sila. It's like building a house on a very not concrete-like foundation. So what is Sila? Here we get into, I think, trouble, because Sila probably historically translated as morality, which is a loaded word, or ethics, a less loaded word, perhaps. But really, it's this intentionality around harmlessness. To live in a way where we don't cause intentional harm. It can also be seen as discipline or integrity. In integrity to our values. So in a sense of what we call in emotional intelligence work, cognitive balance. Cognitive balance is this general idea. Are my values in line with my actions? I really value honesty. How honest am I? I really value kindness. How kind am I? And cognitive balance is when we're able to have our values and our actions and behaviors aligned. And so how much integrity do we have to that at times? And this, of course, is not a conceptual understanding so much. It's really, to me, Sila is about behavior. Dharma practice, to me, actually, is largely about behavior. And if you look at happiness research, which I've been studying lately, happiness is not derived from what we get from the world. you probably all know this, Dharma practitioners. I fall high, I forget like three times a day. The happiness I'm trying, is not, I'm not going to get it from the world. And even the happiness researchers are saying this now. It's actually what I bring to the world and how I am in the world. How am I in the world? Sometimes not so good. And so the reason this topic is fresh on my mind lately is one of the things that's really been troubling to me as I look at the world is it really kind of blows my mind, and it can kind of depress me and drive me into even a cynical attitude. It's just I look at the world and I think, why is it so hard for us to not cause harm? Why is it so hard for humans to not cause harm? What's going on there? I've been really inspired recently by this book written by His Holiness the Dalai Lama called Beyond Religion. And when a prominent Buddhist figure, a religious figure, writes a book called Beyond Religion, I'm very likely to pull it off the shelf. I'm like, what's this about? And a lot of what he talks about in the early chapters is this very idea. That actually what we need, we don't need really necessarily religion, although we don't need to throw it out. We don't need dogma, we don't need necessarily ideas, we maybe even don't even need a lot of the scientific. What we really, really need as a species is to stop harming each other. And however you get to that, it's all good. Doesn't matter what door you come through, whether it's religion or science or psychology, or it doesn't really matter. And so this has just been really, really on my mind as a question that I sit with, and I notice that my mind jumps around a lot around this, and I want to offer some perspectives and ways that I've seen this in my own experience and in the world, in some really actually realistic and authentic ways that we can bring our practice to these very ideas or even these very hurdles that we all find ourselves in. And one is there's kind of two perspectives that people generally land in. And the one perspective, one of them I think is destructive and one of them I think is constructive. And the one that seems to be very destructive, that seems to be very caught up in, is this idea that the people who cause harm, they're just sort of bad people who make bad choices, and we need to just sort of do away with those folks. Right? Whether black or white, red or blue. And the categories are pretty immense. And I find myself oftentimes in this mind of those people. God, what is with those people? I don't even know who those people are. I haven't met any of them. But it's so easy to just categorize, right? Oh, those people. And we just get to do away with those, and there's this kind of, we're disconnected. And right from that very perspective, we're already in trouble, I think. Because there's no interest in cooperation or education. It's kind of just over at that point, right? I've just decided there's those people, and there's us people, and y'all are good, and those people aren't so good, and we need to stick together. And it's not a good perspective. It certainly hasn't done anybody much good. The other perspective, I would argue, which is the Buddhist perspective, is this idea that, you know, in colloquial terms, we would maybe say, hurt people hurt people. And that the reason people cause harm is because they're in so much pain. And they've been through so much. And they've just experienced overwhelm and pain or trauma or the whole drop-down menu of ways in which people suffer. And in their suffering, in their pain, they actually are causing harm to other people. But I find it very challenging at times when my mind wants to go into those people to actually see them as people who are suffering. Like, God, they must be in so much pain to do that. I wonder what can we do? what can I do to help or to be available to, or to be compassionate, or to be kind, or to be generous, or to actually meet that with sila rather than dismissiveness. It really ups the game, doesn't it? You thought paying attention to your breath was hard? Try that one on for size. But I really think at this time in this place, as practitioners, it's really important that we start to think about sila as actual practice. That can be done on the cushion, that can be done in the world. Every day of your life is rich with opportunities to just be blasting people with your invisible sila gun. just taking the high road just because we can. It is so interesting. I find myself having a hard time with this, even with like people I love. Like my parents, my in-laws, my child. And one thing that there's a, I forget what it's called, it's a sort of psychological, technical term, but there's this thing they've realized that when we, in perceptual theory, the way that we kind of assess is that we attribute other people's behavior, we attribute with their character. So the behavior that other people do, we kind of go, well, they're just, you know, bad or wrong or ignorant, or we associate their behavior with their character, which is very efficient, but very incomplete. However, we associate our behavior with our circumstances. How convenient. I mean, I know I shouldn't have said that, but hear me out. If you didn't do what you did, and you looked at me funny, and you know you really didn't, you've disappointed me so many times now, that's why I did said that rude, mean thing to you. And if you think, you know, 10 billion people going back and forth, no wonder why we're in the mess that we're in. Does that make sense? Uh-huh. Watch that in your mind, I dare you. As soon as I do something that's maybe even mildly unskillful, I'm just like, well, it's like I'm constantly pleading this case to the universe why it's okay I did what I just did. And everybody's doing it. But if you do something, right, and this is just the mind's perceptual mechanism, it just, we can't sort of but help do it. But we can be aware of it. We can bring awareness to this. And understand that a lot of the ways we sum people up, we actually have no idea what their circumstances are. We have no idea what 99% of the people we encounter, what they've been through. We don't know what their day was like, what their week was like, what their childhood was like, what their family system was like. Of course, we know what ours was like. So there's two other things I think that you can watch that I've noticed that I think can be very helpful. Two things that are very destructive that I think that we all do. Again, that we don't need to like stop doing, but we can be aware of. And that really contributes to this is, first of all, blame. And second of all, moral superiority, which is associated with the emotion of contempt. But blaming, I think it's a fairly habitual cognitive habit that we can get into really quickly. And it's sort of, I kind of call it, or the Buddha calls it, and I like to bring it up here, the honey-tipped arrow. Right? It's like, ooh. It's like, it's so quick. So easy. And I know that when I, and so to kind of play on this theory of like hurt people, I notice that when I'm actually in pain or if I'm in emotional distress or if I'm sort of good old fashioned having a hard time, I tend to be a little bit difficult to be around. And if I'm already in a little bit of pain and a little bit of anguish, my tendency to blame goes up really, really high. And I get in the state of mind that I call whodunit mind. You ever been in whodunit mind? Whether it's the dirty dishes or there's no gas in the gas tank and there was yesterday or whatever it is. There's no half and half. Who left the deli meat on the counter? You know, all of these things that happen, like, you know what, 300 times a day. You know, and quickly going into this, what, you know, this blaming, this whodunit, this, you know, it's so destructive. And it can be sort of humorous and funny, right, and light, but it can, the range of that can be very, very wide. So we can just kind of watch that. And the other thing I think that's very destructive in the work that I've done with my friend Eve Ekman and her father Paul Ekman, who are sort of the emotional experts in this realm, is this emotion of contempt, which is the way in which we assert superiority, a moral type of superiority. We're sort of better than, or we devalue the other person. It's understood, Paul Ekman would say, that contempt is actually the most destructive emotion. Usually we think anger or fear, but it's really contempt that drives a lot of the destructive behavior in our personal lives. In fact, if you read any books on marriage family counseling, contempt is like the destroyer of marriages and relationships. And it's actually one of the most subtle emotions. It's not like fear or anger where there's a big arising. Contempt, it's sort of that facial expression of it's like universal. Or I also like to add the eye roll. Has anybody ever rolled their eyes at you? It's not nice to be on the receiving end of the eye roll. Is it? Yeah. Very subtle. But can be very, very painful or very, as the recipient of these things, can feel really, really not so great. So it takes, for me, it takes my mindfulness practice to a whole other level of trying to just be aware of the ways in which we do this. And I think when we get caught in this, and I think Dharma practitioners and Buddhists, and I hold myself in this category, I know that sometimes we can easily slip into this moral superiority and sort of feel better than, or devaluing or dismissing certain segments of the population. And one thing the Dalai Lama talks about that I was very, very striking is how he talks about the world doesn't need more Buddhists. He talks about how he is a Buddhist and grew up a Buddhist and he was trained as a Buddhist, but he feels like really what practitioners can be doing is really holding sila, integrity, discipline, really at the forefront of how we engage with ourselves and in the world. I think it would be interesting if sila went the route of mindfulness and there was secular sila practices. And in the cover, you walk down the Whole Foods aisle, it wasn't mindfulness, it was mindfulness, but it was sila. Where everybody was so interested in just being good and kind and generous. That would be rad. And I think also, too, when we think about these ideas, it's very easy to slip into that this is how we want to meet the world, right? But also I think it's really important that we look at our relationship to ourselves. The old saying goes, charity starts at home. So in which ways do I, in my own mind, do I see, so if hurt people hurt people, how does some of my own woundedness or my regrets or my unresolved, I mean, I have things that happened 20 years ago that I still suffer about. You ever notice that? You're like, that was like, I'll be driving and I'll get hypnotized into some old story. And I'll wake up, I'll be like, that was 20 years ago. And I'm like, if I see him again, I tell you, this is exactly what I'm going to say. I'm going to say it like this. Do you ever rehearse arguments? And I find it's like when I can recognize that with my practice, and I can see my mind, wow. But if I can stay with it long enough and feel into what's driving it, it's always something, it's always kind of an ouch. It's like, oh, that still hurts. I still feel sad about that. I'm still angry about that. I still feel mistreated about that. Right? So we see, like last time I was here, I think I spoke about citta. This beautiful concept in the Dharma of this, that where the heart and the mind kind of live. And it's like, that's why I wanted to offer that practice. It's so, I find it to be so tremendously valuable if I can bring awareness to the cognitive landscape of my own mind and just recognize it long enough and take it back to my body. And that most of my destructive thinking or my rehearsing of the argument or all of the ways in which I entertain some degree of harm, when I take it back to my body, it's like there's just something in there that's still, there's like another little sliver in there. You ever have one of those slivers in your finger, like you can't see it, but you know it's there, kind of? You're like doing this for 20 minutes, like, ouch, ouch, I gotta get it out. I feel like we all have that in our citta, in our heart. And when that experience arises or gets activated or comes into our experience by a range of different conditions, my mind goes into this. For me, a lot of times it shows up as a sense of defensiveness, a sort of self-protection through this distorted lens of ignorance and fear. At the core, sometimes I find for me, I was just on this retreat in Santa Cruz in the last week, and I was noticing in my sitting that it was like, I was noticing pain, and then confusion, and then resistance. I was like, oh my God. It felt ancient. I thought, like, if there's multiple lives, I was like, this goes back like eons. It's like sitting, pain, I'm confused about the pain, and I'm resistant to the pain. And that's all the data I got, right? And then I try to bring metta or kindness or a sense of lovingness to that. And I find that at the core of that for me, there can be this feeling of this suspicion or this fear of like, you don't really love me. I think we all have this. Maybe we don't all have it, but I know that I've had many conversations with people about this. We all can have this like below the surface in our database, this kind of what is it about love that has not worked out in the past. Right? So for me, it's like I can get very defensive. Right? And maybe even I can seem like I'm angry or aggressive externally, but I'm actually, that's not what I'm experiencing. I'm not experiencing anger or aggression or even any violence. I'm just so scared that I kind of can switch on this defensiveness, this psychological defensiveness, because I don't want to get hurt again. And I find it serves me so little. At this point, I'm just like, just go ahead and hurt me. I'd rather just like, let's just do that rather than like living in this like almost like PTS filter of like fear. And the reason I make this plug, I feel like I'm making a public service announcement for Sela this evening. And maybe I am, actually. I find that having done a lot of work, as somebody, she mentioned I was in recovery, having done some things in my life that I'm not particularly fond of or proud of, that a lot of my Dharma practice has really been in the realm of Sila, of generosity, of kindness, of service. And I find that actually this Sila practice, as a practice, right, it cleans up a lot of this other cognitive stuff that I would normally want to go at it with my mindfulness and wisdom practice. And if I could just understand the 12 links of dependent origination, I would stop suffering so much. It's like, no. This is not a cognitive endeavor. So frustrating at times. It's really this kind of the way I behave in the privacy of my own mind. The way I feel about myself, the way I think about myself. And that becomes such a transformative practice. Because it's actually getting right down in Gil Fronsdale's book. He has this book called The Issue at Hand, which I love the title of that book. What is the issue at hand here? Like really, really, what's going on? You know, and for me, it's like when I can clear out the rubble, it's like what's going on a lot of times is I'm in pain and I'm confused and I'm resistant. And I don't want to know, I actually don't want to know about, I don't want any more other data than what I just told you. I don't want to know about the pain. I don't want to know about the confusion. I don't want to know about the resistance. I just want some strategies and some mindfulness tools to fix it. And of course, the mindfulness, unfortunately, kind of just keeps bringing you back to the pain, the confusion, and the resistance. Sometimes I feel like a dog chasing his tail. Even if I catch it, I still lose. And then I just got a mouthful of fur. So I think the Buddha, I think the Dharma is not one of these, at least in my experience, the Dharma, it's not been very helpful for me to see Dharma practice as a take what I want and leave the rest kind of thing, which does work in other arenas, I think. But I really feel very strongly that if we just want to be efficient list-wise, this Sila Samadhi Panya is really a great tool and a great framework for us, for I guess we're called householders. We're not monastics, right? Like, I'm not going to shave my head and put on the brown robes. You know, I have a job and I have a mortgage and I have children and I live in the world of external demands. I have to deal with the political, social, financial landscape of the world that I'm in. Otherwise, I find that for me, and one thing I see in the sort of greater world of meditation that's actually getting highlighted now, is when we aren't interested or we don't understand the Sila as a foundational practice and we're just looking for the mindfulness and the wisdom, we can often create what's called a spiritual bypass, where we start using Dharma practice and meditation as a way to maybe justify some of the things that we do, or to maybe pretend like some of the ouch doesn't hurt anymore. I mean, I'm guilty of this also. That's why I know so much about it. I've never seen it in my mind. It's like, oh, I'm great. I'm totally good. Super happy about everything. I mean, if you could just be me for 5 minutes, you would be so stoked. Meanwhile, I'm like trying not to cry internally. Right? It's just like inauthentic way we display ourselves to the world because we don't want anybody else to know. Hmm. I don't want anybody else to know.
But everybody knows anyway.
And we all kind of play this little party game. Right? You know, I feel like in the years of practice, I feel like all I've gotten to the point now where I just kind of just keep lowering the bar. Lowering the bar. Okay. If I can just get my kids' shoes on and get them like some food in the system and get them to the bus without getting angry, I'm basically liberated. Like, that's my bar right now. We just had a baby about 42 days ago. And my seal of practice now is like at 4 in the morning being like, the baby's crying. I'm like, honey, I'll go change his diaper. Like, that's a radical practice. Of like grabbing the screaming baby and like trying to console him and get his diaper changed and bring him. It's just like, I'm just like, God, this is hard. I don't want to get up right now. This one, and I can know I have a 6-year-old who I can't really reason with much, but I know the newborn is not going to. Could you just like be quiet? Could you just regulate your own nervous system? So I want to stop there, I think, and just thank you for having me. This is kind of what's on my mind these days, and gone through so much change and transition in the last couple years. I feel like I can barely keep up with myself. But I do want to take some time to see if you have any questions or reflections about anything I said this evening. So please, any questions or thoughts in your mind, please let me know. So thank you very much.